Okay, thank you very much. It's really a big pleasure for me here to present the results from our group at this meeting. And well, actually, it's even a bigger pleasure because this was a paper with the latest instrument we have commissioned last year. We've commissioned last year at the VLT in Paranal in Chile. And well, most of the talk I will actually concentrate on the very first results from last year's, which we have now published in FJ. And I also would like to draw your attention to the authors here. It was really a great pleasure to work with them, and without the help of this big group, it would not have been possible to come up with these exciting results here. Actually, this is not all of the talk, because in the last half a year, of course, a lot has happened. A new observing period has started. We had more observations in the beginning of this year, in March, in April, at the end of last year, in October, November, and I will also concentrate a bit on the new results here, which are a bit more speculative, but I think are very exciting and will challenge here the theoreticals quite a bit. Okay, I think I can skip now all the introduction to this, because Andrea has very nicely summarized it. I also removed all my movies now from the talk while you were talking. But this would give you an overview of what I will tell you in the next 20 minutes. So what you see here is about 20 times 40 arcsecond field of view seen in K-band with adaptive optics. And what you see here is overlay the regions we have observed with the integral field spectrometer with the Symphony instrument. So whatever you see here is actually is a data cube. For every pixel, you have a full spectrum in K-band or in H in K-band together. And you will see we will concentrate on the very central parts. This is about the S-stars, about the flares, the spectral properties. But we will also see about the other things like the bigger fields, which have about 10 arcseconds in size, to look on the properties of the stellar disks, or even out farther out to see the connection of this disk and the stellar population farther out. Maybe because I'm also an instrumentalist, just to show you how these instruments, these look like. They are typically 2 tons heavy, have several cubic meters in size. They are cryostatic instruments. Our instrument now is one which has a spectral resolution in K-band of about 4,000. We have 2,048 spectral channels, and you get 64 times 32 pixels. So there's a lot of pixels, but still it means that for large areas you have to map on the sky. The heart of this instrument, sorry for that, is what we call an image slice, and this is, in our case, this is the unit which actually slices the image apart that you then can feed it to a spectrograph. And the advantage we are having here is that the instrument in the end is very sensitive. So if you do it carefully enough, in the end what we get is 30% of the photons which come to the telescope actually in the end get converted to photoelectrons in the detector. So it's not true that this kind of instruments are worse in transmission than normal spectrometers. Actually, I think they are better, or at least as good as the most state-of-the-art ones. How does a data cube now looks like, just to introduce you a bit to the technology. So what you see here is now this the central arc second of our galactic center. This is now about an exposure time of 1 hour. And on the lower part, you see the K-band spectrum. So everywhere in the image, of course, you see the bracket gamma emission from the mini spiral, from the interstellar medium. But if you move your cursor, for example, on S2, you immediately see the bracket gamma absorption, the helium absorption, which has, for the first time, discovered by Andrea in 2003. But this now, you for the bright stars, it's actually easy. See, for S4, you see it, the two lines, you can go to S1. As clearly visible as well, the lines here, there. So for the bright stars, it's easy. For the faint stars, it's a bit more tricky, but in general, you get to about 16, 18 magnitude signal to noise in about 1 hour, depending on the crowding and how far you are from the adaptive optics guide star. So these are the data sets we are working with. And so this is now the same field you've just seen in the data cube, and the results we see. What you see here is the central arc seconds. And overlaid now in a color scheme is the number of early type stars to the late type stars. And blue means you clearly see bracket gamma and helium one in absorption. So this feature which you've seen in Andrea's talk. And from all the stars we see here, about 10, a bit more, you clearly can see that 9 out of 10 stars are early type stars. These are just to illustrate that the spectra are really there for all the stars. I can skip this introduction to the problems we see here with all these many early type stars, but now we come back to some of the questions you've raised before. So if we have about 10 stars, we can group them now to a bit brighter one and a bit fainter one. The brighter one are brighter than 15, the fainter one we would say 15 to 16, and co-add the spectra to get a bit more signal for the understanding. And this is the spectra you get. So So you clearly see that the fainter stars, these are the lower ones, have brighter bracket gamma lines, as you would expect for later spectral types. And the brighter ones, narrower and with a strong helium. So if you now put this clearly in a spectral classification, this figure is adapted from Hansen, and the blue and the red lines are what we measure, you really see that the bright group, the stars which are brighter than 50, are B0 to B2 stars. The fainter group, because they have no helium, and from the equivalent width of the bracket gamma, would specify or classify as B4 to B9 stars. We also address the question about the rotation of these stars. Certainly for the faint ones, we cannot say, because the bracket gamma absorption line is actually broadened very much by pressure in the atmosphere. The helium and the bracket gamma lines have actually different widths. The bracket gamma is pressure borne, but the helium one is a good indicator for the rotation velocity. Our number is the 130 kilometers per second. And this is really typical for B stars, like we find them in the solar neighborhood. As you can see, solar neighborhood for the B stars. Okay, the missing O-type stars, this is already from some observation a year before, and seeing limited observation, we had this question, where are all these O stars? We see a lot of Wolf-Rayet stars in the central 5 arcseconds. The field of view is now about 10 arcseconds, but we see not the O stars, so this was a big puzzle for a long time, and the reason for not seeing them is that we have this emission from the interstellar medium, and you just need to have the adaptive optics or very good seeing to be able to remove the surface brightness from the point sources. And now in the central 5 arcseconds, we see about now the 20 O stars. Even looking at these O stars, still giants and super giants, not the dwarfs I'm talking about. So they are there. So the ratio for Wolf-Rayet stars to O emission line stars is okay again. But now let's see what happens to the O stars farther away. So this, for example, is now a field which is about starting at 10 arcseconds, going 20 arcseconds away from Sagittarius A star. And you can do the same like before. Actually, you can go even deeper. So here, because it's not as crowded and the adaptive optics is better, you can go down to 18 magnitude. So you get in the range of seeing A stars already, main sequence A stars in the spectra. And what you also can see, so the blue and the green ones are the identification of the early type stars. And you see they stop here. Actually, they really stop at about 15 arcseconds in the strip, as far as we can tell. We have not covered the full area yet. Here it's more difficult, but the older red ones are the ones where we see CO banded. So these are really late type stars. And the few blue ones are the early type stars. So if we do a little bit statistics of one field, this is deeper. This is again about 1 hour integration. Where we can go as deep, we see that about 10, we have 10 early type stars, and 90 stars in a magnitude range of about 16 are actually late type stars. So we expected this a long time before, that this bump in the luminosity function at about 16 Kelvin magnitude is really from the late type stars, not from the early type stars. You can do some other first-hand statistics and count the number of stars, how many are there in a certain surface on the sky, and you see there are not so many actually at this distance of 15 arcseconds. So it's more like 0.05 B stars in a square arcsecond, so 0.2 is certainly less than one star in a square arcsecond. So this may also give you some indication which of the models for the formation of the stars would apply or not. So this is just now Tal knows, of course, of all these results and knows the problems which are arising from this low surface or space density of the early type stars to scatter them in the center. Now if we go to this counter-rotating disk, so now we are talking about regions from the black hole to about 10 arcseconds in size. So we've seen this before, so until 2003 we had about 20 stars, Levin, Bolobrodov, and Reinhardt, and Thibaut Pumor has already derived that there is a high likelihood for two counter-rotating disks. And now with the new data, with the adaptive optics specifically, we could increase the number of stars a lot. So we now have about 65 stars which are clearly early type from the spectra, and for which we can derive the radial velocity. So for all the stars now we have radial velocities. And you can again see the two groups, so the result is confirmed, and the results actually get much more accurate. You can even now make a chi-square fitting. This is the simplest one you can do. So you can assume two disks make a least chi square fit to the available data to the counter rotating and rotating disk. And you see that the model, this is our projection as seen in the plane of the disk, actually fits both data sets quite well. But you can also see it's not a super thin disk. So there's a scatter in now here in velocity, but which would transfer now in the model to a height above the disk, which is not negligible. So we say these are two disks. This is confirmed. Both have a high stellar content, here about of the order 20 to 40 stars per system. But there is a certain opening angle or thickness of the disk. So suddenly there will be more advanced analysis, for example, from the new orbital bolide analysis from Beloborodov and Levin, but it's clear that we see thicker things, even not very thick things. The opening angle is about 50, 20 degrees. Well, that the disks are coeval, this has not changed. We have just more stars now, and the ratio is still there. So the stellar population, they look coeval, and they are about 4 million years old, depending on the stellar tracks you're using to interpret the data. Okay, what else can we learn? We can now look on the spatial distribution of the stars and plot the surface density versus the distance from the galactic center. So here in blue is the clockwise rotating system, and in red is the counter rotating system. And you already see by eye that they look very different. The clockwise behaves like a disk, so the surface brightness drops from the center and then it goes out to about 10 arc seconds apart, where also the stars get fewer, as we've seen. The counterclockwise system, the red one, actually seems not to be concentrated at radius of 3 to 5 arc seconds. So even just by looking there, you see that there could be a difference. And this is actually another feature you see is that, with the exception of this S-star cluster, it's again a 1 arc second about. So red is again late-type stars, blue is early-type stars, see open tens and bracket gamma and absorption. You see that there, out there we know there are many more stars. This is what we've seen. But here there's a kind of a gap. So the stellar systems, the disks, even more when you look to the dynamics, we'll come to that. There seems to be a real gap in the center. So what you could do, you could now use, you have 5 information for every star, proper motion. So Vx, Vy, a radial velocity, and the X and the Y. The only thing which is missing is a set that you have a three-dimensional representation. And the last coordinate you can actually calculate, for example, by assuming that they are on a circular orbit, either by energy argument that they are on a circular energy, or that the scalar product of the radius and the velocity is zero, that they are perpendicular, or you can project them in, say, they have to be the thin disk, that the velocity actually is perpendicular, sorry, that the radius of the star is actually perpendicular to the spin axis of the black hole. So, but the message I want to bring apart, no matter how you want to constrain now the last coordinate, the systems look like this. So that the clockwise one, this is the top one, if you look face, it looks very smooth. It's symmetric asymmetrically. The surface density is well described with a power law, and it is a sharp inner edge at about 2 arc seconds. We come again to this point. The counterclockwise, however, there are not so many stars here, about 20, has a different behavior. It's much more concentrated and more like a torus-like shape, you would actually say. But many of these data points are actually now from the IS 13 cluster, which is also a particular interesting object in itself, which I will not talk about. So how could you interpret this? So in reaction and Quadra have started modeling this stuff, and actually they see that the central gaps of 1-2 arc seconds you get if you have a disk which has 10 to 4 solar mass stars, and you also see the thickness of the disk is the scale height here, delta Z over R, the ratio what we measure, you also, there is a kind of a threshold around 10,000 solar mass stars, which is quite consistent with what we would get from the number counts and assuming a flatter IMF. So it seems that the clockwise one is a little bit more massive and makes this nice disk structure, and the counterclockwise is less massive and makes a bigger gap and flares a bit more to a ring-like structure. Central arc second. Okay, so we've seen that the orbits, I think about the proper motion, there's not much to say anymore. The new thing what we could do in last year, the one from this year not in yet, is to all the radial velocities. So from now on, for at least 6 of the stars where we have good motions, we can now actually make a full three-dimensional calculation of the orbit. So we break the the degeneracy from the inclination. And when you do this, already Andreas indicated this, and you look now, what is the spin axis compared to the spin direction of the two discs we are talking about? So this is projection of your spin finger now on the sky. So this would be this counterclockwise disc, and up there in light blue, the clockwise system. And for the stars where we have very accurate three-dimensional orientations, these are the dark blue ones. They are definitely not coinciding with the disks. There are some more other stars which are just shown as confidence limits where they could be, but the conclusion would be really that the spin of the central arc seconds of the stars for at least 50% of the star is not together with the disks. And if you would now calculate the Lensiering position just as one of the processes which can change the direction of the orbit, this would for at least half of the stars would not be enough to change the orbit significantly in the lifetime of 10 million years, what we would expect for the stars. So there must be some strong scattering events going on there. Well, the distance to the galactic center was also explained. You can even bring now the degeneracy with the distance as soon as you have a radial velocity. And the more radial velocities you have, the better it is. Andrea had a bit bad luck when she measured the first one because it was so close to a point where you could not discriminate the distance. But now with time, and this was already in the 2003 paper, and now we are filling here with the tech and the VLT to the level what she said, that we very soon will be at a 1% level in distance. So the tendency from 2003-04 to now would be that our estimate for the distance is going down. So 7.6 plus minus 0.3 was the one we reported in the 2004 paper. So then the mass of the black hole, well, it doesn't really change much anymore. It really changes with what you see is the distance to the galactic center. If we now take the full analysis of the distance, take the error bar and so on, we would say at this distance of 7.6 kiloparsec, it's 3.6 million solar masses. Flares. We also could observe flares. We had three flares in the commissioning runs with Symphony. However, they were rather faint. And these are the spectrum what you see. So with Spiffy, you can either have a K-band spectra in one shot. This is what you see here. Or you can have a H and K-band together. But you see in H-band, of course, the extinction of the galactic center already is quite a strong penalty. And this is what you here see is now the spectral energy distribution. And we measure the slope of minus 3. And well, for the calibration, we had this question before. We do it by comparing the slope of the spectra with the slope of S2 and the other stars, which we now know the spectral time and which we know the temperature as from. So we make an in situ calibration, but keeping well in mind that the calibration is certainly an issue. So our data points from Symphony, this would be the slope what we measure for the three flares. So it's really red, the spectrum what we have. So this would indicate that it's the synchrotron tail from the flare what we have. Well, Andreas Eckert will talk about the simultaneous observation of the infrared and X-ray flares. These are now these two infrared X-ray and the lines in July in 2003 and two times in 2004, and well, more about this later. So the next steps. Well, I think it's obvious. It's to cover more area, to go deeper, and to extend the analysis here, which we just have in stripes now, in radial stripes, to a full area on the sky. And since I don't want to go too far here, I just would even jump across the step and go beyond. So last week we had a big meeting at the European Southern Observatory, where the three institutes, which were also involved in the program here now, proposed a second generation instruments for the interferometric focus of the four telescopes, where we think that we will be in 5 years from now not only be able to measure the relativistic effect on the orbits and farther in, which are on the order mi over c of a percent or so is what we will expect. But when you now look on the flare, we would assume that there's some orbit associated with the variation in magnitude of the flare. And you now make here now just that the centroid of the surface brightness, taking all the lensing and so on and light retardation into account. You could actually, if you get to an accuracy of 10 microarcseconds, you would see, actually, this is the theoretical shape of our inclination of 45%, how our object would look like. So our hope is really that in the 4 years from now, we will be actually able now to probe really the Schwarzschild radius, or the last stable orbit. And then we are, of course, at a regime no one has probed before yet in physics. Okay, thank you.
Speakers for being so responsible about their time. Okay, so
were you actually able to constrain the gravity from your line widths, because you have a huge bolometric correction when you say that stars are very luminous? Of course, you're way out on the Rayleigh gene. So a cynic could say that you still haven't really proven that they're not subdwarf O and B stars. So the only way to do that is by getting gravity.
No, we don't have it yet. I just can say that the spectra look fully consistent with what you see with other stars.
But the line shapes, if you have an equivalent width which also has a line shape, can you say what log G is?
No, I can't. Maybe someone else here in this audience would. The spectral resolution is about 4,000 or 5,000. This is what you have to deal with, I think. For the beat dwarfs, probably not, or that you can.
It's a little bit about a factor of 5 and 10. So, if you, like I said, if you wanted to be slightly radical, you would say that you could have stars that are a little bit more massive than human stars. You could have a luminosity entirely consistent with what you see in the table. The only way to move about is by getting one of these.
But sure, we have the H-band spectra as well, as you've seen. We see the hydrogen lines in H-band. So well, in the central arc seconds, we have the normal dwarf stars. The S stars are dwarf stars. Then in the 5 arc seconds, we don't have the depth yet to see the. So this is just from the observing technique. We had to use a larger pixel scale, and we were not able to, in this crowded field, to go as deep. So here in the large field, we only can go to about 15, 40, 50 magnitude in Cape. And so here we won't probe the dwarf. We pick up the old super giants, and if you go farther out at 20 arc seconds, this is where the crowding is not as severe, and where we can go very deep. Then we see again the dwarfs also down to east. In the central arc second, I think you would not just from the surface density, as I said, we see about 20 giants in 5 times 5 arc seconds, so that just the likelihood to see one in the center, I think it's consistent, just the surface. You see?
We have an intra-group question here.
Young stars more at
Would someone like to comment on that, who does the models? But for the most massive clusters we see, like Arches or Quintuplet or 36 or 3 or Doradus, they are at the same age, less than 3 billion years, and all the massive stars are in the center, so I can't.
Question in the back here?
I have a question about your parametric system. Mm-hmm. So this has an astrometric axis.
Sure, for the imaging experiment, which would now be to image stars within a diffraction limit of a single telescope. Here the resolution is about 1 to 2 milliarc seconds. The astrometry now is really to measure the centroid of a flare, which is about 3 magnitudes brighter than what we expect for the stars, and measure what happens within this half an hour if we see some reflex motion there. And this is where we can get the 10 microarc seconds. The proposal we presented was 3 million euros, and now it's up to our science advisory committee to judge.
Oleg, you had your hand up there?
Yo! So, no, I think one of us must be wrong. I don't want to now give a statement what I think. You see, I'm an instrumentalist, and we had a professor at the university where the exams was just to write the result, not how you get to the result, and in the end it comes to this question at some point.
Mark, do you want to make a comment?
A cluster, a disk. That you would say this is not a disk. What? More? More.
Yeah.
Ah. Okay. So the color scheme now is the S stars are the one in the central arc seconds. These are the ones where we say they have no ordered orientation of the spin. So this would be an other representation of the figure you've seen before. The stars farther out, so at a distance from 2 arc seconds farther out, are the blue ones. They are aligned. The black ones are the stars which are in the very center, in the central arc seconds. So they don't match this model. So we are sitting in the plane of the fitted disk. You should see a plane here. So the position angle is minus 28 and 164 degrees. So an ideal disk would be this horizontal line you see here. And the thickness of this would be the scatter round or the opening angle of the disk, what you see here. And this would be our statement. This one looks a bit wider than this one. Yeah, the blue ones are much more.
Okay, we should cut it off now. I'm getting signals from the organizers in the corner. So we will start again at in half an hour.